good evening. I always say if you can't be a great musician, you can hang around them. So that's part of what I'm doing here tonight. Welcome once again. We all appreciate you all being here. In case you're wondering if I'm as quirky as I sometimes seem on the air, well, I'll answer that for you. I have this photograph in my pocket, and it's my father taken at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. My dad and I were really huge Civil War devotees, and some of you know I grew up in D.C. So we would go on weekends to like Harper's Ferry or Antietam, or we just kind of throw a dart at a map and go, all right, it's Chancellorsville today. So, I mean, to be a little mawkish, he couldn't be here, but I wanted him to be here. I think he would have loved this. He would have loved this project. So, anyway. Well, damn, he really is as weird as he seems on the air. Okay. quickly, the format is as follows. You know, we're here to talk to Brian about this wonderful, wonderful project. And I admit, you know, again, I'm biased, and you know some of the context. I just grew up fascinated not only by the conflict itself, but the music. I mean, I was that kid singing Battle Cry of Freedom on the way to school in second grade, and my friends like, Temptations didn't do that. Anyway, we're here to celebrate this wonderful recording and just to delve a bit into, you know, here's some of the music if you haven't heard the CD, and I would, you know, it's available wherever fine music is sold, as they used to say.
Actually, it's available right.
Yeah, there you go.
The front door.
And that's places like lobbies like ours. Anyway. So we're just going to talk, and then we'll, again, as Kari said, we'll leave time for you all to trade fours with the organizer of this great event. So I just wanted to lay that out for you. You come from D.C., you try to read from, I shall read from a prepared statement. But we're just going to go right into it and then play some excerpts. So Brian, let me show you what I did to sort of emphasize the quirk thing a little more. I have an outline here, and I have
a battle plan.
Yes. I have Hardwick, Vermont written here. This is you. And then I have Jubal Early. If you're a Civil War buff, you know he was a Confederate general. So
Early's problem was he was late to battle. So
it's true, yeah. But a boom, two shows on Sunday. But so my first question is, how did you get here, metaphorically speaking? Here, you know, you're a musician interested in a tradition, the tradition, and you come up with the better angels of our nature. So just let's start with that. How did you get?
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, I mean, the big question of like how does someone from Hardwick get into jazz in general? And that was just, I don't know, VPR. I believe in it. This is not a VPR plug. This is just reality. Oh, VPR was my connection.
I'm sorry, just kidding. Sorry.
VPR was my connection to the music. And so growing up in Hardwick, you know, the days of Neil Charnoff, and you know, hearing those the records being played and playing along with those records, so that gave me that connection, that outlet to be connected to the music. Fast forward many, many years later, you know, I got I received a Vermont Arts Creation Grant back at the end of 2014 to do a, you know, unnamed project, large ensemble project, and so then my wife, who is also my producer and my manager, she's back there. Everyone say hi to Linda. Hi, Linda. And she's the producer. She's the main executive producer on this album as well, and did a fantastic job. So we were kind of brainstorming. You know, what we have this great opportunity to write some music, but we really want to take full advantage of that opportunity. So let's come up with the right idea. You know, and at that point, one of my sort of go-to, all right, let me clear my mind, is going to the Ken Burns Civil War series, you know, watching that series and just, you know, being that Civil War buff geek that you, my friend Ruben here, also is. And, you know, hearing, there's a great point where Sam Waterston is, you know, he's the voice of Abraham Lincoln, and he says that last paragraph of Lincoln's inaugural address, the Better Angels paragraph, and it's such a beautiful human moment from Lincoln, and that the spirit of the better angels of our nature. He wasn't able to reach that spirit in that time, but it was, you know, like Lincoln had said in other points, you know, it's the what we say and what we do is not for this time, but for a later date. And things that came after those events, you know, and some of the, and to me, some of the best angels of our nature is that creative side of humanity. And for me, being in the realm of jazz, that creativity, it just kind of all of a sudden those two ideas connected with the idea of Lincoln's Better Angels and this artistic language of jazz. So that's how that connected.
Well, I think that, you know, in the interest of time, and so we can get to your questions, and because, as Grace Slick once said, talking about music is like, no, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. But, and I would, I'm a first cousin of that with talking about it. But we're going to play the first excerpt from The Better Angels of Our Nature. It's, boy, I think I brought a recording of this in the third grade, what do you call it, show and tell? I mean, like, I think his mom dropped him on his head. Anyway, there's a couple minutes of the Bonnie Blue Flag, and then we'll talk a bit more about the Brian's methodology and how we get from, and when I said Hardwick, you know, I didn't really mean that it was just from where you were geographically, artistically, to where we are with this fine recording. So we can hear the first example of the Bonnie Blue Flag, please. Okay, you can be, as Duke Ellington used to say, victims of your own good taste and purchase this, but just talk a bit about, let's call it merging traditions. My colleague Robert Resnick has a show called All the Traditions. So, you know, you kind of laid the groundwork out concerning where, as we used to say back in the day, where you're coming from artistically. And so you have this other American musical stream. And before you answer this, I just want to give you a compliment. I think it's very difficult, in my opinion, to successfully merge these things without them sounding hackneyed or, you know, like an apprentice tailor where you go into a wedding, but you still get, like, the chalk marks on your cuffs. Yeah. And so, you know, kudos in that. But, you know, just talk about your – how do you marry these strains?
I guess the best way to go about it is, you know, is being honest and true to the music, like, first and foremost. Like, all of the songs on the album, you know, I researched for long periods of time. I mean, even went to the Library of Congress, not to the physical Library of Congress, but to the Library of Congress and their website, and, you know, got the original sheet music for these things, studied those, you know, played through, hacked through some of them on the piano as best I could to understand, you know, them in their original form. And maybe even some, you know, going further inside of the history of the songs and, you know, where they came from. So this particular one, Bonnie Blue Flag, was originally the Irish jaunting song. You know,
dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-d
different sort of time signature. So I wanted to keep some of those traditional elements in some way, the spirit. I guess that's really what it boils down to, is finding the spirit or the spirits of what the songs originally entailed. And how do I translate that through, I guess, my artistic vision in this particular sense? And this song is probably the most modern style on the entire album. It's as modern as I can, you know, make it, I guess. But it's not that I wanted it to be that way. It just ended up wanting to be that way. You know, in a lot of ways, the way I compose, the way that I arrange music, it's, you know, it sounds kind of hokey. It sounds kind of corny in the sense of, you know, it's not me that's writing the music. The music writes the music through me. But it's kind of true. It's, you know, it's one of those things of, if you pay really close enough attention to something, you'd be surprised what you start to learn or what you start to hear. And for me, paying as close attention to music as I do, the music does start to kind of talk back to you. And it starts to say, you know, you want to move in this direction, or don't move in that direction. So as you're sitting there and you're trying things, it will, if you're paying close enough attention to it, it'll say, no, how about this over here? Oh, yeah, you're right, music. That's right. And then it works. Mm-hmm. Or at least I think it works.
It's like something in Sidney Bechet's, the saxophonist Sidney Bechet's autobiography, Treated Gentle, when he says, you tell it to the music and the music tells it back to you.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, I've noticed, too, that you've done a wonderful job of keeping the melody intact. But again, you know, I'm going to use the term marriage again because there's some really deft, sublime stuff going on with the harmonies, but it's still the song I used to sing, you know, in my corner when I was a school safety patrol guy. But it's, so that's, you know, again, that's what I was referring to, being able to keep that part of the tradition in there without, it's not an either or kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's, and that element right there, that's the thing, again, going back to this concept, the music of the Civil War era, these songs, especially in American culture, they're really well-known melodies. I mean, you know, half, probably more than, well, maybe half of the songs that are on there are very, very recognizable melodies, melodies that we learn when we're young kids. And we can, you know, many generations can you recognize these things instantaneously. That element was an important element for me because this project was really for me. It was a large ensemble writing project for myself, for Brian McCarthy. It wasn't for this person or that group. It was coming through what I wanted to do. And I wanted to really test those limits. But at the same time, you know, I wasn't at a point in my career where I could go full original, like, you know, people have never heard. It's harder to get an audience to, well, let me put it to you this way. It's important for me for an audience to have something to hold on to. And if you're going to make the roller coaster ride really adventurous, you really need to have something solid to hold on to. And these songs are very, very solid. You know, audience members can latch onto it. And having that element there, those melodies, these very recognizable, strong melodies, having that element to hold on to, now I can take, now I got you. I got you. All of a sudden, you're going for a ride. And I can take you on whatever ride I want to. As long as you feel comfortable holding on to it, I can be as creative with it as I can be. And this project has really lent itself to that.
Let's hear a bit more of this historical musical roller coaster ride. This is Battle Cry of Freedom. Count Basie in my dreams. I'm going, all right. Hey, Freddie Green. Anyway, so here's another example of you getting, I'm going to go back to my metaphor pseudo-thesis, going from here to there to meet with this other way of expressing things musically. Obviously a different arrangement. When I first heard it, I thought of those wonderful solos, bassist Jimmy Garrison with the John Coltrane Quartet, and even after that group broke up, you know, the latter D groups with Alice Coltrane and all that, and then we're on this journey, we're kind of marching, to use a military metaphor, toward the song people know. So you want to just talk a bit about that?
Yeah, this one, this part of the song, because I might even show you that there are two parts of this song, and why there are two parts of the song. We'll get there. Put that off to the side for a second. This song actually kind of predated the project because I had written part of this maybe back in 2013 or 12 in another form for a kind of high school big band form. I had got some charts together that I wanted to make accessible for maybe a high school or early college level group. And in doing that, you know, I studied with some really wonderful composers and arrangers, Jim McNeely, Bill Mobley, who's on the album, and Rich DeRosa. And Rich, who's done a lot of work with Lincoln Center and Wynton Marsalis, and he's off in Germany doing things and heading to UN. He's all over the place. And he had this great idea of making things very accessible to students. And I took that idea a little step further, and what I did, I wanted to make the music this arrangement of it, some other avenues of exploration for students and maybe even band directors to explore and then connect them to jazz a little bit more. So I actually take a Wayne Shorter composition by the name of Deluge and take an element of that and try to kind of superimpose these two things together. So you get... So you get this... So those two songs merge really well, and I just thought of it as an opportunity for, like I said, for students to explore these ideas sure. and connect them to Wayne Shorter.
You know, it's hard not to. This could be my English major coming out, but one of the things I've also thought a lot about when listening to Better Angels is this: what this conflict meant, what it means, and how, at least for me as a listener, these references, like, see, having Wayne Shorter in the midst of Battle Cry of Freedom, and that can mean a lot metaphorically. It can mean a lot historically because you've got this continuum, and you know, maybe the Civil War was about many things, but in some respects, it's about, okay, metaphoritis number five. It's about Wayne Shorter, you know, black saxophonist from Newark, and the battle cry of freedom, if you know what I mean. I thought about that too with some of the solos on the record. Like, there's I think it's on Dixie when Mr. Magic by Grover Washington is. So it, you know, and I'm in my apartment yelling, like, oh man, it's like, yeah, we're still here. It's the continuum, but it's that possibility. And I think that's something that's also really present in these arrangements. Okay, calm me down. My Southern Baptist comes out even way up here. We're going to go next to one of Brian's originals, and I'll talk a bit more about your, as they say in grad school, your methodology. This is the title track. It's The Better Angels of Our Nature. So we'll hear a bit of that, please. Okay, again, The Better Angels of Our Nature. Two questions. I should have done this right off the bat. Some Southerner I am. Where are my manners? If you could give us the personnel on the recording.
Okay, personnel. Let's see, top to bottom. So we just heard on the flugelhorn and trumpet, Bill Mobley. On tenor saxophone and soprano saxophone, Daniel Ian Smith, who's here
who's
with us.
Here, yeah.
He's here with us, yeah. Woo! Stantuan Kendrick on tenor saxophone, Andrew Gutowskis on baritone saxophone, Cameron McManus on trombone, Zach Harmon on the drums, Matt Arnoff on bass, and Justin Coughlin on piano.
Ooh. I don't know how many of you saw this ensemble at Flynn Space back at, that was 2015.
Yeah, 2015.
Whoa,
yeah.
Time flies. But just, what's that, like the room was on fire, you know. But, and, you know, I've thought about this again throughout the recording, but how do you write for a band like this? You know, Duke Ellington always comes to mind with me, and I was wondering about your relationship with the respective talents of the players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a nice that you bring up Mr. Ellington, because that's, you know, how can you be a composer, especially a jazz composer, without having that sort of influence on you? And what's one of the things that Duke did really well in his lifetime? He wrote for the people in his band. He said everybody in that band was a featured soloist in their own right. They had their strengths that he could write to and bring them out. And that's an important lesson. That's something I took to heart. And so knowing everybody in this group, I think maybe the person that I knew least was Matt Arnoff on bass, but I knew his reputation. I knew he could, what he was, I mean, actually, I'm not entirely sure if there's anything he's not capable of doing. My friends, Stantuan and Justin, knowing their strengths, I can kind of set the stage for them to succeed as best as they possibly can. So I'm keeping those things in mind when I'm writing these songs. But, oh, man, this would be great. Flugelhorn right here for Bill Mobley. Oh, man, he'll be in heaven on this part. So that ends up being there for him. And then when the song transforms into the next part, that's for Stantuan and Justin to take off on. So, yeah, I'm definitely keeping that idea of, I don't think there are actually any weaknesses in the band, but there's certainly like the whatever the personal strengths are in there, I want to bring that out. I want to like just throw a fastball right down the middle of the plate so they can just knock it out of the park. That's, if this were a few months ago, you would have gotten a basketball analogy.
The changing same. We have a couple more pieces from the collection that to share before we open it up for questions. And I'm trying to hold back because the last piece is, I might get a little nuts in here in a good way. But this is another piece from the period, so old school in the literal sense. This is Weeping, Sad, and Lonely. Holding back, like trying to keep from crying.
Let it out. It's okay.
But
it's a safe zone.
Whew, yeah. Boy, now you know what I look like on the radio. Okay. going back to your Wayne Shorter analogy again here, thinking about again, the melody of these pieces and what I think for me endures where songs from this period are concerned. There's a, whether they're sentimental or whatever, there's a sincerity, I think, and I just thinking about the way you merge these harmonies with that, and it made me think of kind of like smoke over a battlefield after, something has taken place, or when you're driving down 89 in the morning, you see that mist over the bottom. So what were you attempting to convey here? I know this is like one of those PhD thesis defense questions, so you don't have to go.
Oh, no, I got this. Don't worry. Yeah. No, this is one of those, multi-layered, multi-sort of reason behind this piece as well. It's a large group. It's, six horns and a rhythm section. Lots of rich, bombastic harmonies throughout, especially throughout the album. And this comes right before that final, one of the final pieces in here. Sort of almost like a sorbet for the ears in the sense of, like, let it boil down to the trio.
I'm loving it. I'm like, just,
baby, I don't have a better way to describe it.
No,
so let it kind of all boil down into just this trio, and it really does. It acts as a sort of like, it's almost like the listening part of your brain can get overwhelmed from such a project like this. That's so rich in the harmonies. So letting it boil down into the trio and letting them have at it. Justin and Evan, Justin and Matt and Zach have at it in this beautiful way. And at the same time, it's another two-parter piece. The first part that we heard, it's really most of the original, basic original harmony intact. So if it reminds you of that Civil War era, well, that's, essentially not all that unchanged. Maybe a little more jazz modern voicings on it, but the essential original harmony behind it. And it's probably, as far as the non-originals go on the album and the piece, it's probably the least known song on there. So again, going back to that, what I described earlier, that, the handlebar, that thing to hold on to, if I'm going to take you on that adventure, which I do in the next part where the rest of the ensemble comes in, very, very adventurous reharmonization and all the fun PhD words that I use and techniques. I first need to get you there by having the trio present that melody to you in this really straightforward way. Now you know the melody. Now I can take you on that ride.
You know, I'm going to start using some of these. Sometimes people say, where are you going with your programming? It's like, it's the handlebars, baby. It's the handlebars.
Just got to hold on.
Hold on for the sorbet. Yeah. Okay. last but not least in this segment of the program, and again, we're going to open it up to you. I had the great honor of having this ensemble here in 2015, and Brian and I kind of went off before they did Daniel Emmett's Dixie, and this is what I say, I've been in Vermont 5 years, I say, the northerner I go, the southerner I become. Vermont has made me like straight, uncut, proud southerner, and I think having distance from my geographical and I was born in Black America. Home has given me insight into many things, including, I think, this music. So, I mean, with that in mind, Brian and I were talking before you all showed up, and just thinking about what a song like Daniel Emmett's Dixie means. It can mean different things to different people, of course, but as an African-American, as an African-American Southerner, it's, for me, and I think this comes across in the music on the collection, period, to be part of the firmament, whether it's musical tradition or culturally, and to be an outsider at the same time. So for me to be a Black Southerner means I am rooted in this, and the older I get, the more I see that. And yet, there's blood in the ground. So if, here, and again, this is his music, so I don't want to go on here, but if I sing I wish I was in the land of cotton, old times there are not forgotten. Well, old times there can mean a lot of things, like Wallace in the Door or Emmett Till. But again, I think what you've done well here is address complexity in an approachable way, whether it's harmony or, in the case of a song like, we're going to hear an excerpt from A Lightning Rod, a song I have great musical affection for. I think it's a beautiful song, and you've never stopped a cocktail party until you're a Black man who stands up and says, yeah, I think that's a beautiful song. Even the olive stopped talking. Anyway, let's hear an excerpt from, what was the original title of the Daniel Emmett?
I Wish I Was in Dixie's Land.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. I want to scream so badly. I want to scream so, Justin Coughlin on the piano. It's like,
oh man.
Yeah. What's happening across the tracks while the guys in the gray are coming through? Anyway, this for me, of course, my love for this song notwithstanding, is just, it's one of my favorite arrangements on this. And I really am curious about, if you could just talk a bit about where you were thinking, again, the gifts of the players notwithstanding, but it's such, I think even the excerpt we heard, there's so much going on musically, and for me even visually. So if you could just address that.
Yeah, this was the one that took a lot of, like, you needed to come to the, I needed to come to this song very correctly, you know, and not in a, you know, a nonchalant sort of way. It needed to be very serious, and everything that's it's done, and it's done by design, and, you know, intelligent design, in that sense of knowing what I'm doing and what I, it's such a difficult subject to talk about, the song. Like, as you said, I mean, it's a beautiful song. It's a beautiful melody. It's a melody that we probably grew up singing. And it means different things, very different things to, very similar people. And, you know, how do you get that into a piece of music like this? So, you know, transformations and having music pick up where words kind of start to fade away and don't do the subject justice. So here I can kind of take you through some of that mindset of setting the stage of the melody. You know, you get this brighter end of things. And then all of a sudden, you know, bringing in some of the darker elements of it. So you set that stage like that, and then the transformation takes place on the next, you know, part of the melody. Dark before, nothing up my sleeve, the same melody, all of a sudden, becomes powerful. You know, so that transformation, again, the melody stayed the same both times through, but the feeling of it becomes more complex, more real, and in a lot of ways, taking these elements, these primordial elements of jazz, getting in the gospel elements,
oh yes,
and the blues elements,
oh yes,
and bringing that out, that kind of takes that power back of whatever maybe negative symbols that this song has, you know, latched onto, or those, you know, vice versa, taking that song back, and what better, as we were saying before, what better language to address this subject of what this song entails than the language of jazz.
Yeah, I thought about the what we used to call church changes, chord changes in the arrangement, and Charles Ives' unanswered question, and how this may connect to, well, again, the music, but also the subject, you know, and the war and how far we've gone, and again, forgive my English major talk from coming out here, but it's the best kind of lecture or panorama in a way, you know, I think what you've done here musically. Did you have specific instructions for Justin, like play something that's going to make Reuben Jackson roll over in the floor and like
now,
pass
man.
A collection plate to people who aren't here, because you know, my neighbors probably can't stand me. It's like, oh, he's playing that piece with that gospel piano.
Apparently I need to move next door to you.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting Justin Coughlin, the piano player on this project, when he was this 17, 18-year-old monster. The school that I went to, William Paterson University in New Jersey, again, no plug, I'm just, you know, stating facts here, people. It's a school of monstrous young jazz musicians. And in a school of monsters, this 18-year-old Justin Coughlin blew the roof, the ceiling, and somehow the floor off the entire place. It was incredible, this kid's talent. He's an adult now, but we've had the pleasure of doing many, many projects, and getting to kind of grow up in a musical sort of way with him in Clark Terry's band, and our connection with CT. Words didn't need to be said for what Justin, throughout this entire compositional process, he knows what to do. And I know he knows what to do. So I just kind of have to, you know, set the stage for him, and he takes it from there. And what he did was, you know, the spirit, I say in the liner notes of Dixie, you know, that spirit of Frederick Douglass, and to agitate, you know, that civil disobedience spirit into it. Is Justin, just agitate this for us and see what you do. And yeah, he knew what to do.
Thank you. We've got about 15 minutes. I hope you didn't mind that we kind of went on a little more than we planned, but I think the music and the discussion
was.
See, I'm Baptist. We say 5 minutes is like a half hour where I come from. But if you have questions, Kari Anderson's got the microphones. If you just raise your hands in the air and wave them like you just don't care, we'll see the continuum. We'll go from there. A rhyme. Anyone?
I have a question. What, in your research about the Civil War era, the period, what really surprised you about the pieces, the originals, that then informed some of your interpretations?
I think probably one of the more surprising things, well, there were two on there that kind of stuck out. One of them was a Battle Cry of Freedom, having two sets of lyrics, one for the North, one from the South. It was probably the most popular song, arguably the most popular song of the era. And then finding that it was so popular that the North had their lyrics and the South said, yeah, well, we like this song too, but we're going to sing it with our lyrics. And so they had, so that was kind of a cool thing for me to, I didn't necessarily discover it for the world, but I discovered it for myself. And I found that fascinating. And that influenced the idea of having two separate interpretations of that song on there. That's why it's so long on the CD, is that it's basically two songs. And then the other thing, finding out and discovering for myself in the research of Dixie, or I Wish I Was in Dixie's Land, and its authorship, sort of having some debate of who actually was it Emmett, or was it an African-American minstrel band, the Snowdens? There's definitely historical evidence to support that perhaps they both composed this song, you know, maybe one, maybe the other, but truth probably lies somewhere in between. So for me, that, you know, finding little tidbits like that, or large tidbits like that, was it impacted what I was doing.
Any other questions? Don't be shy. Don't be.
Brian, what's next?
Well, if you want to see this project live, we're going to be playing at Vermont's newest arts center in Greensboro, Vermont, of all places, Highland Center for the Arts, on August 18th, 7 p.m. It's a beautiful new venue, and we're getting the band back together, man. So I'm kind of excited about that. But I also have a quartet project album in the works that's going to be, we're doing a CD release at the Flynn in December as well.
So, Brian, if you were able to turn back time and talk to your younger self, would you have maybe addressed yourself, helped yourself, you know, entering this new era?
Yeah, definitely. What I would have done was I would have told me to do this project about 4 years earlier. Then I could have tied it into the, you know, the Civil War anniversary, the 150th, and marketing takes care of itself at that point.
Love the music. Absolutely love it. Thank you. I haven't heard the whole thing, so I don't know if this question of mine is relevant or not, but I know Renee Marie, a vocalist, has covered some of the Civil War era, some of the same songs, actually, and I wondered if you ever considered using a vocalist on the project.
I had thought about, you know, that in my head, just I have a lot of experience writing, you know, for the nonet, for this sort of, for this exact instrumentation. So it's a sound that I kind of clearly have in my head. And so, you know, balancing act-wise, taking on a project of this size, I kind of felt like, all right, let's start here. And then maybe some future projects pulling in that vocal texture would be lovely to work with for something else.
If I could just tag on to George's question quickly. Renee Marie is a wonderful vocalist from Virginia, as it turns out. And that there's a medley of Dixie and Strange Fruit. I forget which collection it's on. But see, again, this is, you know, one person's interpretation, but here's someone who is, you know, rooted in Virginia. I mean, the state of Virginia, you go from Appomattox to, you know, the Loving Case. Is all the chords exist in Virginia where the American experiment is concerned. And, you know, what the way she interprets it to me is, this is my home, and there's this stuff that happened, and it's worth looking if you go to YouTube. But it's a good question, because, you know, the lyrics do tell a story in and of themselves.
And, some of these songs, they come right from, you know, people's poetry. You know, Ethel Lynn Beers and her poetry, and essentially Julia Ward Howe. I mean, it's just poetry set to music. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so is it on? There it is. First of all, I want to say the music sounds a lot better in here than it sounds in my car. So
you just need a new sound system.
Shout out to the architects and whoever designed the place, because you did a nice job. I'm delighted that we have one of the band members here. So I'm wondering if Mr. Smith would like to say something about what it was like to play on the gig. And
no, you don't.
What that
don't ask
was.
Me those questions.
Well, I do want to ask him that question. So take it to him.
Yeah.
It's probably mostly a blur for him at this point.
Yeah, Brian should be afraid, very afraid, I guess.
I paid you, right? Right?
The check didn't clear from what I recall.
Yeah, sorry about that. I got to work on that.
That's all right. Actually, I have that's a beautiful question, and I have several comments to address to that. But the first I'd like to make before I make any others is I don't know how much you all know how what pair of gems you have here in your community in front of you right now, between Brian, who's an incredibly talented saxophonist and especially composer. I've been in the music business for over 30 years. I teach at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. One of the things that I love to do the most as a saxophonist and a woodwind player is play new music. And Brian's project has been one of the most inspiring and inspired and enjoyable projects that I've been involved with in a very, very long time. So it was a great privilege for me to be part of it.
I don't think I paid you enough. No way.
Well, that's a conversation we'll have later. but also, I'm now a part-time Vermont resident, trying to be a full-time resident. And my plug is I'm also a member of VPR. But I listen to Ruben's show every Friday night, and even just sitting here this evening and having had conversations and discourse with Ruben over the last year regarding this recording, the insight that this gentleman has is more profound than I think we realize. So I think both of these gentlemen deserve such a round of applause.
Oh, you got to pay him money too, right?
Because you really, in this, I firmly believe in community, the two members of this community you have here is very, very special, very, very precious, and very, very profound.
Well, it's definitely, it's three members
thank
now.
You. Well, thank you, and I'll take that. So even some of my neighbors consider me part of the community, which is not easy to do in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. but anyway, yeah, my experience was nothing short of, like I said before, inspirational, exciting, enjoyable, challenging. I am a little disappointed that there was a soprano solo on Battle Cry of Freedom that got faded out just before I started. So, but that's okay.
A couple notes in there.
So anyway, one thing that I have to echo in some of Brian's sentiments before is I'd like to make note of also Justin Coughlin. And this is something that I share as an educator at the Berklee College of Music,
You know, I think we all have questions about the state of education, the state of commitment in our world, in our country, especially in terms of consistency, in terms of commitment, in terms of passion and dedication. And I must say, the very, very first rehearsal that I went to for the, you know, in anticipation of the two nights of performing we did at the Flynn Space, I can't believe it's 2 years ago now. It's hard to believe it's that long ago. You know, Justin Coughlin, if you don't know, is without sight. And he lost his sight, I think, when he was 9 or 10 years old, somewhere around there. And as a musician, if any of you are have any musical ability or any musical background, if you look at Brian's charts, for example, several of my charts, if you stand up and I hold the edge of my chart, the bottom is hitting the ground, and there's still several pages that haven't been unfolded that I'm reading from. Well, Justin doesn't have that privilege of reading the music. And I will never forget the very first rehearsal where obviously Justin's not reading music and he's got everything down. And here's a couple of guys coming from New York, and here's, you know, Mr. Berklee College of Music professor, hotshot guy coming up from Boston to, you know, flex his muscles. And I'm reading, and I had gone through the music and I was prepared. But, you know, this kid sitting at the piano doesn't have the privilege of any of that. And anytime we had to rehearse a section, you know, Brian would just say, oh, yeah, we're at letter C where the melody goes like this. And he'd sing a couple of notes, and Justin would say, oh, yeah, I know where you are. No. And that alone, the conviction, the dedication that Justin had brought to this music, I think speaks volumes about the quality of the music that Brian compiled, that he arranged, that he organized, that he composed. And to the credibility of all the musicians that he surrounded himself with. So those are just a couple of my comments. Mm-hmm. But the most important is, don't take these two gentlemen in front of you for granted in this community. They're very, very beautiful people. And Ruben brings you such beautiful music every Friday night. And thanks, guys, for what you do.
Yeah, man. So. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, once again, we'd like to thank each of you for coming out and having, again, I'll quote Duke Ellington, who said some of his compositions came from beauty experiences. So we've had some of the beauty experiences brought from the soul and skill, or, you know, Quincy Jones talked about jazz being soul and science. So this man, Brian McCarthy, give it up for him, please. Man, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruben.
I'll tell you quickly, when I first got wind of this project, you know, I don't know how you beg on email, but I was, you know, I was on the ground like James Brown at the Apollo doing, please, please. Like, if you play somewhere, please let me introduce. Oh, please, please.
I think you were actually, when I made the announcement of, like, when we chose the project, you know, you do the social media, like, hey, what is... Has anyone out in social media land like the idea of Civil War music and jazz? First person to comment, Ruben Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Boom. And I'm like, excuse me, what?
Yeah, I'll bring my own heart attack and everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you coming to Greensboro? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm leaving tonight. I'll just be there like a month.
Are you marching to Greensboro? What is this?
I'm pitching a tent, you know. Anyway. So this... you know, this ends the program. Please, we have copies of The Better Angels of Our Nature for sale in the lobby.
Linda, my wonderful wife, yes, manager, yes. Producer of everything.
Refreshments.
I couldn't tie my shoes without her.
All right. So, again, thank you. You know, talk to the artist.
Yeah.
Many thanks again for you coming. Thank you.